I'm happy to be here and introducing Dane Terrell from Crop Services International. He's the Director of Sales and Marketing and Soil Consultant for Crop Services International and Flower Field Enterprises in Portage, Maine. Flower Field Enterprises is a leader in the small-scale vermicomposting industry for the last 10 years, and Dane has was employed to develop a compost tea program there. So please enjoy. Thank you for being with us, Dane.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. Keep smiling. Send good energy up here. I'm a little bit ADD. You won't see me stand still very often. I'm going to talk to you about biological seed inoculums and activators. And here's my message. Use them. Okay, now what do you want to talk about? No, just kidding. As Nicole mentioned, I am from Michigan, not Maine. Not that that matters, but I am from Michigan, from Crop Services International. My name again is Dane Terrell. We do soil testing and consulting, focusing on remineralizing soils. Basically, what this corn stalk is, remineralization and biological activation. We want to find some sort of balance there. How many were in Val's presentation this morning, Val Dixon? Okay, good, because what I'm going to do is kind of build or go a little more into detail about the soil food web to start, 15 or 20 minutes, and then I'll go into specific inoculums and things that you should look for. We do have Crop Services was started 20 years ago by a gentleman by the name of Phil Wheeler, Dr. Phil Wheeler, who authored the book, The Non-Toxic Farming Handbook. Anybody read that book? That's a really good book to kind of take all of the different paradigms, the Reams, the Albrecht, the Energetic, and Callahan, Ingham, all these different paradigms, and try to make you understand that not one paradigm is truly the answer. It's better to pull all these paradigms together. So again, we focus on remineralizing soil, biologically activating soil. I am a soil food web advisor, been trained by Dr. Ingham. We do fertility recommendations, and of course, we sell product. I'm not going to sell you any product today. I'm not even going to talk to you about our product name. I'm going to just kind of give you an education about what you should look for in these seed inoculums. Through Flower Field Enterprises, which was started by Mary Appelhoff, she wrote the book Worms Eat My Garbage. Anybody read Worms Eat My Garbage? She was one of the pioneers in creating a compost environment indoors through vermicomposting. So I had the fortunate experience in a previous life to build a golf course. And you're going to say, what does a golf course have to do with here, what's going on today? Well, under the direction, under the strong arm of my mother, she told me, didn't ask, told me that I needed to do it as environmentally correct as I could. So after a couple years of planning, this was in the late 1990s, I met with a couple golf course superintendents and said, can you go grow a golf course without chemicals? We know they're one of the worst at dumping chemicals into our land, into our soil, into our water. Can you do it without chemicals? And they all said no. I said, okay, I'm not going to hire you. I'll find somebody else. So that went on, and I finally found a superintendent who had an open mind, was aware of a biological product. So with that, I grew in putting greens on a golf course from seed to playing on them in 3 months. I germinated a bent grass, L93, which doesn't mean anything to you, but it's a bent grass that goes on the putting greens, in 36 hours. I called the seed salesman up and said, you won't believe this. We just germinated your bent grass in 36 hours. Typically, it takes 4 to 7 days for bent grass. He put me on to the agronomist or the seed pathologist out in Oregon. I told him that, and he called me a liar. I said, okay. So 3 months later, we cut our first cup in the golf course. Cup cutter is a round thing that goes in the ground, take out the soil, you put it in the plastic cup. When we cut that cup, which are 9 inches deep, we had roots growing out the bottom of it. So in 3 months, we had basically built a root structure on that plant that we cut at 250 thousandths of an inch, that's how tall they are, with 9-inch roots, which kind of dispels the belief that your roots are only going to be as long as what you have above. Okay, make sense? We cut our watering back 50%. We didn't use any fertilizers or fungicides for 3 years. So that's where I got my start. That's how I learned about biology. If I can maintain that system, then I started an organic lawn care system, which is the compost tea spray service. We've done that for 10 years. We've eliminated all fungicides, herbicides, and cut watering down in the Kalamazoo area. Okay, let's move on. Any questions about me? Why am I here? I know. I think it's important when we're doing presentations to educate and inform people, they get a better grasp of what soil biology is. Val did a great job this morning at a kind of a broad spectrum soil biology. I'm going to key in on a few of those microbes and actually show you pictures of them. As we know, and I'm talking about healthy soil, there's a very, very, very large number. Very large number. And to put that in perspective, I don't know if anybody's ever heard this, but how long does it take you to count to a million if you say one number per second? The answer's up there. You don't have to guess. Okay? It takes 12 days. How about a billion? 32 years. A trillion? 32,000 years. If you want to get your calculator and figure it out, it's pretty close. What I think is interesting about what we're told about the number of microbes in our soil is that directly correlated to the time it takes to count them. Okay? 1994, when I first started looking at this, they said there's a million microbes in the soil. I just read something that said there's 50 billion microbes in the soil. Okay? So it wasn't 31 years later that they figured that out, or they must have been counting by two. I'm not sure how they got there so quickly. So I think the number is going to keep growing as we learn how to count faster when it comes to microbes. Here's something from 2000, and right up here, you know, when you're speaking and you bounce like this, this means you're nervous. Okay, so I'm nervous. So here's the different things I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about bacteria, fungi, protozoa, and nematodes. How many of that's the first time they've ever heard those? Good. We're there. And I'm going to talk about them in healthy soil, not from a stethoscope, but from a microscope. How many have seen pictures of microbes? First of all, let's talk about bacteria. Kind of different forms of bacteria. They're decomposers, solubilizers, and they're mutualists. There are some names underneath of these microbes that we've probably heard about. Rhizobia, Azobacter, Bacillus subtilis, and Thuringiensis. Generally, they're alkaline by nature. So let's put that in perspective. If you're in a forest soil and your pH is 5.2, you're going to have bacteria in there? Probably not very many, because a forest soil is going to be more acidic. Physically, under a microscope, they're round, they're rod-shaped, and they're spiral. Fascinating, right? One interesting fact about bacteria is they have the largest percentage of nitrogen of any living organism. That's bacteria. So when you're wondering where you're going to get your nitrogen from in organic production, focus on these things in the soil. They'll produce all the nitrogen you need for the whole entire growing season in a healthy soil. When you have them out of balance in a soil, and I'll talk about balance even more tomorrow, but when you have them out of balance, and Val talked about this morning, you'll tend to get more really high, you'll tend to get more weeds. Really low, then you tend to get more later successional plants. Say that again? Okay, if we have a really high number of bacteria, low number of fungi, but high number of bacteria, typically we're going to have more weedy species. okay? And I'll show a succession slide down here later. When we have a very high number of fungi, low number of bacteria, that's what you see in the old growth forest. And it's all about the feed source, just what Val talked about this morning, the food source available to those microbes. So, here's a picture of compost tea. This is magnified 400 times, This is magnified 400 times under a microscope. Picture we took, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago. So I would like to tell you that every one of these dots in here, big, small, and different, are bacteria. Because of this slide, I can't tell you that. I'd have to watch them under a microscope to see if they're actually moving or not. The real small dots that actually do come up pretty good on this slide, like right there, or right there, right there, those are bacteria. Those are probably cocci. They're round. I do have a couple what we call bacillus. They're the rod shape. There's one there. There's one up there. And when we look at under a microscope, you have this layering effect because we're looking through liquid. So you have a layering effect. So you're going to have stuff that's in focus and stuff that's out of focus. So if you think about my comment before about counting microbes and think about the ones that are in focus on this slide versus the ones that are out of focus, that's a lot of bacteria in one pipette drip of water. Multiple, and that's coming from a gram of soil, but we could extrapolate that number back out into how many bacteria would be in a square foot of soil, how many would be in an acre of soil. That's how they come up with the thought that there's basically two cows per acre of in weight of bacteria. This here is a fungal hyphae. This is something else we look at. We're talking about just a second. This is actually organic matter. Some of it humified. Some of it is humus. Not all of it. Currently, these microbes all around this, protozoans, which I can't see on here, but they're actually chewing on this stuff. If we were doing this in a video session, you would actually see them moving. Looks like they're bumping. You can't see their teeth, but bumping against that. And then this whole system, looking at our microscope, is moving. Bacteria basically spin. They don't have a lot. They're not very motile. The protozoas, which I'll show you pictures of coming up, very motile. I mean, they're flying through underneath your screen. And then the fungi just grow. So their hyphal tips, they keep growing out. Next group of microbes. I said it was going to be short. I can't do the whole soil food web today in an hour. Different types, decomposers, break down the lignins, the cellulose. For example, in the woods, we have the leaves and the tree bark. Bacteria can't break that down. They don't have the acidity to do that. Fungi do. Therefore, in the woods, we're going to be more fungally dominant because that's the food source. Versus the prairie, where there's just grass breaking down or being stomped down, the bacteria can consume that. They can break that down. That's not as fibrous. There's mutualist. How many have heard of mycorrhizae? Good. Pathogens. How many have heard of Fusarium? Rhizoctonia. So there's good guys and there's bad guys. But really, Rhizoctonia, Fusarium, those different types of soil fungi, yes, they're bad guys, but they're really good guys. Okay, when they attack your plant, don't eat the plant. It's Mother Nature's way of saying, this plant is not healthy enough to consume. Now, in our infinite wisdom and conventional system, we go spray a fungicide and we sell the product for somebody else to eat. We don't eat it. Somebody else does, okay, because it wasn't minerally dense enough to do it. But that's neither here nor there. There are a lot of beneficial fungi, and we'll talk about those. They're acidic by nature. I covered that. Common, Trichoderma, Mycorrhizae, Verticillium, Clonostachys, Bovaria, different names of microbes. Physical shapes. You saw the thread-like structure. They can convert organic matter into humus. They produce glomalin, and that's how we sequester carbon in our soils. We have to have fungi. We have to have plants producing the sugars and the carbohydrates and the proteins. The fungi then take that, produce that, and sequester that carbon in our soils. Out of balance in the soil. Back to the weed question before, typically we lose some compaction, or we gain compaction. Fungi create particles or aggregates in the soil so that our soil becomes more friable, so we can grow plants in them. We aren't growing on concrete, basically. So here's pictures of fungi. Incidentally, this is probably not a beneficial fungi up here. Most of our fungi under a microscope have color. Tan, orange, red, brown. This one is a clear. This is probably either Rhizoctonia or Fusarium. This is the fungal spore. This is where it started, right here. And these are just different pictures. We can tell how good or bad a fungi is typically by their hyphal diameter. So when we measure this right here, you'll see this 6.63 micrometers. We can measure that on the microscope and say, okay, that's a beneficial fungi. This is mycorrhizal fungi, endo and ecto. This is just another picture of fungi. So that's fungi. Protozoas, very important nutrient cycler in the soil. Over 900 or 1,000 soil tests, biological soil tests that we've completed over the last 8 years, protozoas are one of the main missing ingredients in our soil food web. We see a lack of protozoas quite often in our... You all right? Bring me a different colored chair. So protozoas are one of the main nutrient cyclers in our soil. Okay, they consume bacteria. That's their main food source. And remember what I said about bacteria has the largest percentage of nitrogen of any living organism. Okay, protozoas don't need. They have a smaller or a larger carbon to nitrogen ratio. They don't need all that nitrogen in their bodies. So they poop it out in a plant's available form in the right time, the right place, and the right form, right in the rhizosphere of the plant. So if you want to do some math, I didn't do this math. I actually, Elaine gave me the, allowed me to use this. Basically, 8,000 nitrogen molecules mineralized per protozoa per day in a gram of healthy soil. If there's 50,000 protozoas, that's 400 million N molecules made available each and every day. Everybody following my math here? See why nitrogen does not have to be a problem in your farming system if you have a biologically active soil? That equals 7 nanograms of nitrogen per gram of soil per day. A growing plant needs 0.2. Remember, we're breathing 78% nitrogen. We have to have the microbes on the leaf of the plant, in the soil, to convert that to a form the plants can feed on. That's your nitrogen. We just covered it. So, again, protozoas, we're missing them. 900 of these biological tests that we've done, they're one of the things that are low. Just incidentally, how do you fix that? Get your soil food web in balance. Okay? You can use oat straw or any type of brown material when it's growing in the soil. When it starts to senesce and turn brown, protozoas actually will insist themselves up in the stalk of the plant. Then you can take that plant, put it into a liquid, add some air, and they will come out and do a protozoan infusion. And if you want to know more about that, ask me. I'll tell you how to do it. It's very easy. Some of the garden catalogs, if you have a koi pond or something like that, if you have algae problems, they have these little hamster balls and you fill them full of straw. Anybody ever seen these? Fill them full of straw and throw them in your pond. You're basically inoculating with protozoas. That's what it's doing. When I was building that golf course, I cleaned up a whole acre and a half pond using oat straw, just throwing it in the pond. Saw it happen with my own eyes. Nanograms. Here's some pictures of your protozoas, the most common ones. Flagellate, this isn't a great picture, but there's a tail right here, or flagella. That's how they move through the soil solution. Ciliates, They have cilia. These are all things that we learned about, remember, in 10th grade biology class, paramecians, amoebas. Yeah, that's the same thing. We forgot about them. And then the amoebas. They move around. They kind of sloth through the solution. Rotifer is not actually a protozoa by name, but it's one of those later successional mineral solubilizers in the soil, and it's a good thing. Next group is nematodes. Not all nematodes are bad. That's the first thing to know, and most of you are already here, I'm sure. Most are beneficials. Another main nutrient cycler in the soil. If you're lacking nematodes in your soil, it's something we need to get inoculated. The best inoculation for nematodes is a quality vermicompost. How many people are using vermicompost in one way or the other? Good. That's the best inoculation that we find is in vermicompost. Basically, different groups, bacterial feeders, fungal feeders. We do have switchers, and that's all about food source. They'll go in and start eating bacteria, and all of a sudden the bacteria numbers fall off. They'll start eating fungi. So they kind of adapt to their environment. Pictures of nematodes, fungal feeder under a microscope. This is how we identify them is morphologically. This is a stylet. And they actually go and they'll suck juice out of the root of a plant. Out of the root of fungi. It's a symbiotic thing, but it's also, if it could be killing a bad fungi. So if you want to get your fungal pathogens reduced, make sure you have the full gamut of nematodes because they are your friend. They will help reduce some of those pathogen problems. They'll eat good guys too, but that's just Mother Nature. It's eat or be eaten. This is a bacterial feeder. This is a bacterial feeder. These are bacterial feeders. And all we can tell is by their mouth part. That's how we can tell the difference between them. And there's hundreds of nematodes. These are just a few examples. Do you have a question in the back? No. These are predatory nematodes. They actually consume other nematodes. Some of these pictures we've taken, some of them are from Elaine. This is a root feeder. You can see this little muscle right here. And it has a stylet, and it goes, and if you've ever seen carrots that look like this, anybody seen these? Okay, this isn't a GMO carrot. Okay, we're not trying to get more carrot. This is the gall that was produced by the root knot nematode. See this muscle here? Pops in there. No. Now, the way to fix that, don't put down nematicide. Don't go kill every nematode in the system. That's what they do in conventional system. Go put the beneficials back in there. Compost, vermicompost, get the soil-fed food web working again. Microbes function in a healthy soil. So if you're going to take all that information and put it into this, here's what these microbes can do in a healthy soil. First of all, they decompose the residues. Okay. First and foremost, if you don't decompose your residues in a healthy soil, the next season, and you bury them, for example, and you have a bunch of bad guys there, you're going to feed the bad guys. And next June or July, when the condition's right, you're going to have fungal problems. So it doesn't matter if you're in a vegetable system, a row cropping system, an orchard system, you want to get those residues broken down with aerobic microbes. Aerobe meaning with oxygen, the beneficials. Because if you don't, and the anaerobes eat it, you're just feeding the anaerobic population. And that's just going to present problems come next summer with some type of disease. Very important for seed germination. They protect that first radical from soil pathogens. We're finally getting to soil inoculants, I know. You're wondering if we're ever going to get there. We will. They solubilize the minerals during the growth, flower, and fruiting stage. They liberate the minerals that the plant needs for those specific stages of growth. They build and improve soil structure. The key word here is balance. We have to have balance. We have to have the full set of microbes in that soil to achieve that balance. Okay. Any questions so far? I know that was a lot in 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes, however long. Yes. How do you know when you're balanced? Well, doing biological tests helps, okay? but also using other testing methods, for example, soil testing methods, checking mineral levels, and I'll show you tomorrow, if you come to my session tomorrow, how when we have a baseline test with a baseline biological test, and we test that again next year, and we test again the following year, and we only focused on putting biology and feeding biology there, if our mineral content goes up in that soil, for example, phosphorus goes to from 60 pounds to 250 pounds, that's when I'm saying we're getting balance. At least we brought that set of microbes in. You can do biological tests. We can look under a microscope or do a Solvita test to some degree and say, okay, we're seeing bacteria to fungal ratios in the right numbers, we're seeing the right amount of protozoas, and we're seeing nematodes. That's balance. Best I can answer it. You and I can talk in short afterwards if you want to at this point. Yes? Yeah, typically. Typically. Oat straw, barley straw, both of them. Mm-hmm. Yep. Elaine claims you can use alfalfa. I've never used it. I don't know that. My understanding is when the plant turned brown, when those protozoas encysted themselves up in there. So I use a brown material. And I have done protozoa infusions. It's interesting. Yes. Great question. What's a non-target protozoa? Yeah. So typically when we looked at those three basic ones, amoebas, ciliates, and flagellates, typically the ciliates are an indicator they can function in low oxygen environments. So in theory, they're a non-target, something we don't want in there. However, if we're working with a soil that's not in very good condition right now, meaning we don't have good friability and texture, maybe the ciliates are what we need in the short run to get that thing moving to make way for oxygen so we can get the beneficials there. So I don't really focus on not putting those specific ones out. Okay, any other questions on, yes? Certainly, if you use too much of it, okay? So what you'll catch by the end of this, I hope, is you'll, when you think of seed inoculums and you think of Dane, you're going to think of diversity. So those things are good. The yeast and those things that are more of a fermented or a anaerobic process are good also, where they're needed in our soils. But we need everything out there. Soil we don't even know. You know, we know to 5% of the microbes that are out there. So the more we can put out there and let Mother Nature sort it out, the better off we are. I'm sorry, I thought of it when she asked that. I'm sorry. Okay, go back through, ask your question again. Okay, seed germination. We're going to move on. Try to get to the seed inoculums. Seed swells up with moisture. Everybody understand that? Okay, good. Cracks, and the first radical shoots out and down. We cool there? Like the intestinal tract of a newborn, void of any gut flora, as is that same radical, unless it brought something from the mother. Many of you probably know we're not getting the most quality seeds in the world when you buy them. We can have disease coming in from the seed source, the mother seed source. So, when I said at the beginning, put a seed inoculum on. It's your first line of defense, either to protect that unhealthy seed that you're putting in the ground, to surround it with some competition, to surround it with some beneficial microbes, is your best chance at taking that so-so seed and making a decent product at the end. Okay? So it's very vulnerable at the same time. If your soil is full of pathogens and it's anaerobic and it stinks, you're going to set yourself up for failure. So that's where that seed inoculum can make a huge difference. I was talking to a gentleman earlier about this, and I said, if you have a very healthy soil, and it's the minerals are balanced and the biology is moving in the right direction, is a seed inoculum going to make a big difference? Probably not. You're already there. You've got all these microbes there, but that's not what we're dealing with 95% of the time. We're dealing with very unhealthy soils that have come off 40 years of hog manure or chemical application. So 99% of the time, it's good to put a seed inoculum on. And again, I can't emphasize enough, we want the full gamut of bacteria, fungi, protozoa, and nematodes. So in this, my key here is inoculation and protection. Get them out there. Needs of the radical. So that radical shoots out and down. That becomes the main root of the plant. Okay, so the more that we can protect that with these microbes, and we can have the solubilizers, they're going to produce or solubilize the nutrients this plant can grab onto right away, the better that plants get a start and build that structure or that foundation to have a healthy plant. So we need to have solubilizers in there. And we, you know, when I showed you before, some of them are bacteria, some of them are fungi, some of them are the protozoas. We need to have that full gamut. Obviously, we need to have moisture. We can use things to provide some trace minerals, seawater, kelp, our different ideas to put in row around that seed or that seed inoculum that gives us a small amount of trace minerals. Again, promoting that biological system so we get those trace minerals into the plant. And incidentally, yes, even in cold soils. Microbes can change the temperature of a soil 1 to 2 degrees. And if we can promote that, what happens in the spring, at least up in my area in Michigan, for the last 10 years, we've had a cold, wet spring. Plant pops out of the ground and sits there. And the problem is it's lacking phosphorus. We start to see a little bit of purpling of the redding of the leaves. And that's because it's not because of lack of phosphorus in your soil. Don't go throw MAP and DAP on it. Go throw some molasses down or some fish down. Promote those microbes that are going to solubilize phosphorus. But the best thing to do is put right in the seed, with the seed. So nutrient solubilizers are important. Here's an example of a seed inoculum. This gentleman is in Pennsylvania. Fortunately, he does trials with everything I tell him. So this side of these 5 ears, this is deer damage here, these 5 ears got the seed treatment. These 1, 2, 3, 4 ears had no seed treatment. They all had 2 gallons of fish, a pint of kelp, and a gallon of molasses in row. See the difference how much nicer these ears are? This one's got a little issue here, but he was honest. He just pulled 5 ears and 5 ears, and that's what he showed me. So that's the benefit of a seed inoculum. That's all he did. He's not going gung-ho into the way I'd like him to go. So, everybody wants to know specific microbes. We could do a 7-day class, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and cover a very small amount. So I'm just going to show you a picture of some specific ones that I pulled out, just because I think they may be common names that you've heard added to products. Maybe not, but I find them interesting. Acinetobacter, it's a bacteria. It colonizes a seedling within 3 days. What's interesting about this one, or a lot of interesting things, it eats diesel oil. So if you have a diesel oil spill on your farm, make sure you have Acinetobacter in there because it'll help protect that seed and feed off the diesel oil and decompose the toxin or decompose the oil. It's a pea solubilizer, so it's a phosphorus solubilizer. Azotobacter, bacteria converts soil N and atmospheric N to a protein the plant can feed on, Azotobacter. There's a trade company out there that sells Azotobacter. Bacillus, this is the family name. There's a lot of different ones. They secrete plant growth hormones and antifungal compounds. There's a Bacillus product from Bacillus subtilis or subtilis, a certain strain that's actually sold as a biological fungicide. Pseudomonas, they're solubilizers. They break down toxins. Peptococcus enhances germination in high cadmium soils. Not a problem around here, but when you get out to California, we see this. So this would be one that we'd want to make sure we have in our mix. Penicillium. The stuff we used to take for phosphorus and calcium. helps solubilize phosphorus and calcium, simply penicillin. Trichoderma is an antagonistic fungi against soil pathogens. Clonostachys is actually attaches to the root of a plant. We use this a lot in grains, and we outcompete Fusarium head blight with great. I'll actually show you a slide down the way. Mycorrhizae absolutely should be in every seed inoculum there is, and you'll say, well, yeah, but I'm planting brassicas or whatever. That's okay. Put it in there anyway, because it's about the whole soil food web. That mycorrhizal fungi may attach to a cover crop root or something, a companion plant root you have next to it, solubilize phosphorus that actually feeds that brassica plant or that blueberry plant, which typically don't associate with mycorrhizae. So the whole point here, I put 2016, that was actually 2015, I'm way ahead of myself here, 2,000 individual species were tested on 500,000 acres. I'm not going to tell you the name of the company because it's a naughty word, but I don't really understand the benefit of testing an individual species in the soil. You can do it in a petri dish, absolutely. But as soon as you put it in the soil, that's a whole different environment. Okay, so when you're out there looking for an inoculum, back to broad spectrum, back to diversity, we have so little clue of what these microbes do, it seems counterintuitive to me to test the individual microbe. And put it in perspective. One of you, Jane? Owen. We're going to take Owen and go drop him in the middle of New York City and say, change this town. Make sense? Why does an individual microbe, why should we be testing individual microbes? I don't understand. So my point, my message to you, is get consortiums, those groups of microbes, because together they can make a huge difference. I did some work with Michigan State University, and I was working with them on a compost tea program in the a professor of horticulture, specifically working on botrytis on grapes. And I was telling her about brewing compost tea, and I wanted her to add to the tea, I wanted her to add some trichoderma, which is an antagonistic fungi, and some Bacillus subtilis, so that we were skewing the numbers of those microbes that I know have antifungal properties into the tea. What she proved to me on a petri dish, is she took a petri dish with Harzanium, took a petri dish with Subtilis, put botrytis on both of them, and then took a petri dish with Harzanium and Subtilis and put botrytis on there. Together, they were, I don't know what the number was, 65% more effective, killed 65% more of the botrytis together than he did alone. And we're still targeting individual species. It doesn't make sense to me. So diversity is diversity. If I haven't plowed that in enough, talk about diversity. Rebuild or mimic the soil food web the best you can. So our diversity includes nitrifying, solubilizing bacteria, we want the nitrogen fixers. Solubilizing, we want all the nutrients, not NPK, all of them, cobalt, selenium, whatever else, we need them all solubilized. The decomposers, we want those in there so they're out-competing the bad guys that are in our soil. We want some that have insecticidal properties, meaning BT and verticillium and things like that, that actually have some, we can have shown control over insects using those, and then fungicidal, Trichoderma clonostachys. This is a picture, the same farmer that had the other. This is a different field with the blue corn. This is a seed treatment. This is no seed treatment. And it's interesting because when you look at a soil test, he has a boron deficiency in the soil. And what's that mean? That tip of corn or that piece of corn wouldn't be there. If you don't have sufficient boron in your soil, that corn cob will not come complete with a corn on the tip. That's the way it's supposed to be. But if you have a boron deficiency, that'll show up right there and farther down. But these two are the same field, one with a seed treatment, well, fish kelp and molasses, one without. Now, the easiest way and the most inexpensive way to get seed inoculum is to make your own. I'm a salesperson, but I'm going to stand up here every day and tell you to make your own. And I'll tell you why. Number one, indigenous species. You want stuff that's coming off your farm. Good, bad, or indifferent. But don't just take it from one spot. Go take it from 8 or 10 spots on your farm. Your compost pile, your manure pack, your in the forest, and mix those all together. I'm going to ask, how do I put that on seed? Make a liquid out of it. Make a compost tea out of it. That's simple. If you have problems, I'll go on that in a second. To that, you want to add some kelp or some seawater. And the reason we want the kelp or the seawater, number one, is trace minerals. We want a broad spectrum of trace minerals down around that seed. Add carbon. When that radical shoots out, the first thing it's looking for is carbon. Okay? Make sure there's carbon out there. That's those microbes are looking for carbon. They need a source of carbon. I don't care if it's biochar, humates, humic acid, fish, kelp, molasses, or all of them together. That's your carbon source. Make sure it's in there. Then you simply take that liquid, spray it on your seed, soak your seed, put it in furrow, put it through your water wheel transplanter, spray it in your hole. I don't care how you get it there, get it there. Simple. Okay? 4 to 5 gallons per acre is sufficient if you're using like a in-row planter. Don't need a lot. Probably cost you 30 cents to make that liquid, 30, 40 cents a gallon to make that liquid, so you're talking about a couple dollars an acre. Does take some time, does take some energy. Okay? If that isn't something you want to move forward to, then there are, and I say that's a good, that can be the best too. Thank you. Let's go back here for a second. Molasses, yes. You could add that, yeah. Molasses, fish kelp, molasses, any of those things could be added to there as food for the microbes and a carbon source. Here was the first farm we worked on in 2008. I want you to note here. We were called in April of this year and said, and this was a friend of mine, actually family friend of mine, said, come on out. I've been doing this compost tea at that time for 4 or 5 years on lawns. Come on out. We want to start working our farm towards a more biological system. Said, okay. So we put a comp. We actually built a brewer. We had 400 acres. They had 900, 400. They want us to work on. So this was the first field we worked on. And I'm not saying that compost tea as a seed inoculum fixed this field. This field was in piss poor shape. Excuse the expression. Okay, 20 years of hog manure applied to it. Phosphorus and potassium was through the roof. So the things I want to note here is we have a compaction layers at 11 and 18 inches, over 350 pounds. I used a compaction testing. I went out in the field and did it. I was the one that did that, so I know that. Over 300 pounds, 350 pounds. Do that. We put compost tea in furrow at 5 gallons to the acre. We did another soil drench about 2 days after planting using compost tea with a humic acid. And the reason for the humic acid at a quart per acre was, I said the phosphorus and potassium ratio or numbers in the soil were extremely high. I wanted to tie up some of that phosphorus. I didn't want to limit the uptake of zinc or some other nutrient. So we wanted to lock some of that up. And that's what that carbon, that humic does. And then we did that with a humic. We did a foliar feed on 6-1. So it wasn't just the seed inoculum, but it certainly was part of the toolbox. We were out there on 6-19. Joe and I went out, walked through the field with the farmers. And we decided to dig up a plant. Now, we're talking about, what's the May 5th it was planted. This was so 6 weeks later. We pulled up plants, and look at this taproot. It was 22 and a half inches long. And remember, we had a compaction layer at 11 and 18 inches. That shouldn't happen. But when you coat your seed and that radical with microbes, compaction layers can become less of a problem because now we have the microbes around that root tip feeding the root and scavenging the soil. Because typically in a compaction layer, you've got anaerobic conditions. You're producing alcohol, which every root will turn away from or die. But those microbes were keeping it aerobic enough to let that plant go through there. The fact that we could pull that plant out of the ground was amazing to me. Yes? Yes, I always recommend diaphragm pumps if you have that availability. This was right through the seeder, on the one that went on the seed. This was just liquid and furrow. And then the other for the boom sprayers, we switched from centrifugal over to diaphragm pumps, yes. And that's just to save the microbes. Some centrifugal pumps are like a meat grinder. They'll just grind up all your microbes. And I'm not saying that's necessarily bad. That protoplasm is really a good thing too, because it's full of nutrients. Okay, I'm going to speed up. At the end of that year, 41 bushel the acre. That's not much. I understand that. This field, I think, was at 29 when we it wasn't the previous year had been in corn. It was at 29. We went to 41.6. We beat the county average by 6 bushel the acre simply by putting a little biology down. So, if you don't want to do the compost or build your own, you can go out and buy seed treatments. Okay? Don't just go buy mycorrhizae. Mycorrhizae in the soil is a weak sister. Okay? It can't outcompete anything. Is that a double negative? Don't just apply mycorrhizae and expect wonderful results. Use mycorrhizae in addition to the whole diversity that we're talking about. Okay? That's when you're going to get results, because it's my understanding, and nothing against Paul Stamets, because I love his book, I love what he's talked about, is until you have that food web working, mycorrhizal colonization won't occur, okay, to the level that it should be. So use it in addition to your other set of microbes. So back to, we want all these different types of microbes. We want to add the kelp. We get the plant growth hormones, the cytokinins, auxins, and gibberellins. Raw kelp and soluble kelp is helpful, so we've got some early and we've got some later on. For the trace minerals, mycorrhizal fungi, yes, put it in there, and then the carbon source. Okay, and the one very important thing about the carbon source is these microbes are going to feed on something. And if that plant is not producing exudates yet, because it's just a seed, there's nothing for it to feed on, especially in unhealthy soil. Okay, so put the fish, put the kelp, put the molasses, put the humic acid, different things with that, or make sure it's in that product that's going to make a better product for you. Okay, I want to keep flying here. So that's a little bit better if you want to buy one. Now, the next one is take the either the compost tea product or the one you're buying, and then if you have certain conditions, there are specific microbes out there that will help. Clonostachys, Trichoderma, Bacillus subtilis. We can add those to your program to make your best inoculum. This is a grain report on this is actually in Pennsylvania, and this was taking a specific microbe and adding it to a seed treatment. This gentleman has averaged his Don vomitoxin levels on his grain of about 13.2 parts per million. That's you can't put that in animal feed, you can't put that in human feed. It's too high. Okay, so we added this seed treatment with some Clonostachys. He's down below 0.5 parts per million. Now the idea here is to really get the soil food web working, where we don't have to keep doing these additions. We just aren't there yet. Key to seed inoculums, This is what the thing, if you're going to write something down, this is the things to write down. Balance, diversity, we want protectors. Consortiums are better than individuals. We want solubilizers, activators, fish, molasses, humic acid, and then let Mother Nature sort out the rest. Questions? Yep. Yes. Hold on 1 second. I'm going to give you a microphone. Hold on. Let them finish that one. I'll go back. Yes.
Do you find that certain nutrient combinations will favor the fungal activity versus ones that will favor bacterial activity? Like, for instance, in the carbon source, you know, using molasses versus using biochar?
Let me answer it this way. Do I need to restate the question since he's... Okay. Let me answer it this way. If you're going to use a product like biochar, load up the biochar first. Don't put naked biochar on anything. And that's a global response. You talk to the biochar people. David Yarrow has been written up in Acres many times. Make sure he's got the four M's. Mineralize, moisturize, microbialize, and I don't know what the... Something other. Micronize, I think. You know, make it smaller. So... load up that biochar. Do I see a difference between different mineral levels and microbe levels? When you look at nitrates and ammonium, yes. That's going to be a very bacterial system. You know, if we need ammonium for the growth and fruiting energy, I want to see more fungi in there. And if it's not there, we got to get it there because we're never going to produce the ammonium we need to go through that growth and fruiting stage of that plant. Let me think about that question. Send me an email and I'll process that. Other questions?
I have an indoor worm composter that somebody gave me with a fair amount of the vermicompost that needs to be emptied. So how would you use it at this time of year? My ground is not frozen. It's just a backyard.
How big's your garden?
Oh, I don't know, 15 by 20.
So small?
Yeah, small.
You could do one of two things. Either put the vermicompost, spread it out over the entire garden, depending on how much you have, or hold it and put it in row with your seed next spring. You're better off maybe perhaps putting it in row with a seed if you don't have a whole lot of it to make it go further, and let that then just keep building from that system. Yes.
I wanted to comment on bokashi because my understanding is that bacteria is facultative and it goes from anaerobic to aerobic.
Some are, yes. That's true. it depends. I mean, there's facultative, there's aerobic organisms, facultative anaerobes, and anaerobes. So ciliates, I mentioned before, which is not a bacteria, they can be, they can function in low oxygen environments too. So it just depends on the microbe. There are anaerobic. So go ahead.
So the next one, you touched on something that's very dear to me. You said...
My mother, right?
You said we haven't gotten the microbes. We are still inoculating because we haven't gotten them to hold forth on their own, I'll just say. And I wondered how many years you've been doing it, and just I'd like you to comment on that.
In my lawn care business, I have tests that start day one, at the end of year one, in the middle of a second year. Typically in lawns, we see progression fast enough that the end of the middle of a second year, six applications to 2 years in most soils, we can stop inoculating. In row crops, in gardens, it depends on how bad the soil is. I've seen stuff happen in months' time. I'm seeing stuff that I'm still working on 2-3 years later that we're making progress, but we aren't there yet. I have a grower in the Thumb of Michigan who's certified organic. He has been for 11 years. He's been making his own compost for 7 of those. He still moldboard plows, which I'm totally against from a biological system. But it's how he manages his weeds. And I can't fight with him and say, no, don't do that, because it's the only way he can control his weeds. But he knows enough to put the foods back out there to stimulate the fungi to grow back out. Turbulence, a disturbance is horrible on microbes, especially fungi. So it really depends. I hate to use that term, but it really depends on what you're starting with. Other questions? I think we've got to get one more. We'll take one more here. Oh, we'll take two more if they're quick.
So I have a lot of acreage, well, like 10 acres of pasture that I'm trying to, and so if I were to be, I have a sprayer on the that I could put on my four-wheeler and I could put some of this stuff down. So my question would be, what would you think would be the best time of year to do it, or is there really?
If your ground isn't frozen right now, I would love to see fall is the best time to start. If we can inoculate with microbes, you got to remember, and we don't even know enough to really talk about this yet, but microbes are at 38 degrees, there's a set of microbes that are going to be working. At 55 degrees, a different set, and those went to sleep. At 70, a different set, and those went to sleep. But then as it goes back down, and when the ground's frozen, there are still microbes working in that thatch layer. And that's why you can take corn stalks and turn them under and get them gone by spring, because there's microbes working.
So I could go home, assuming the snow's not staying, and put some on now, and then in the spring do it again.
Absolutely.
And then during the growing season, I mean, how many times a year?
How much time do you have?
Okay.
You know, good. It's really once a week, every 7, I mean, blueberry growers that are doing every 7 days.
Okay.
You know, because they're used to that system. So it really depends. Will, how often are you putting down teas? Not often enough, probably.
Once or twice a week.
Yeah, see, he's a vegetable grower, once or twice a week. So it just depends on what you have time for, you know, certainly. There's one question over here, and then we'll wrap it up.
If you're moving from a bacterial situation where you're growing annual vegetables and you want to go to more of a perennial orchard situation, you just bring in a soil imbalance and figure it'll get more fungal with time?
Yeah. So what we're trying to do is switch from bacteria to fungal. Okay, how do we do that if we're going to grow fruit trees or blueberries or something like that? So what we want to do is start putting down food sources specifically for the fungi. Wood chips, wood chip compost, straw, anything like that that takes fungi to break it down, and then do an inoculation.
Leaf compost from the forest, would that be?
Leaf compost is going to be more bacterial, and I didn't talk about this microbe, an Actinomycetes, which is actually a bacteria, looks like a fungi, functions like a fungi. You see that in leaf compost. I'm not saying it's bad. It can start the process, but really we want that woodier substrate to as the food source.
Wood chips.
Wood chips, yeah. Wood chips, sawdust.
Sawdust with horse manure?
Sure. Make sure it's not too hot. We don't want it, you know, 170 degrees when you put it down in the around the base of your tree or cook a tree, you know. So make sure it's digested. Thank you very much. I am speaking again tomorrow more about the soil food web. So if you'd like to come see that, or if you're sick and tired of hearing my big bald butt, that's fine too. I'm around for questions. Thank you.